Thank you for downloading this program from the BBC. This program is part of World War One on the BBC. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/ww1.
Over the last 43 days, we've been looking at the events that led Europe from a period of prolonged peace into a dreadful war. I hope we have also given you a sense of what that world of 1914 was like, what its values were, what its preoccupations were, how instantly it went from peace into war. For this final omnibus edition, I've got some time to take a step back, to pick out some of the key themes, and to ask what it is that we can remember of this very short period that had such huge consequences for the world, and ask ourselves perhaps if there are any lessons. In my view, the war was not inevitable, and I think it is dangerous to think that it was so. We tend now to think that because there were so many possible causes of the First World War, it was bound to happen. And I hope that we've shown you that it happened not just through a series of blind blunders, but because people actually made decisions and took risks that they knew might lead to war. Having said that, we have to accept that there were tensions in Europe before 1914. There were national rivalries, economic rivalries, competition for colonies, arms races, and I think fears of the others. But even so, there were attempts to reach across from one alliance to another, attempts to try and negotiate some of the tensions out of the way, come to some sort of agreements. In the summer of 1914, for example, the Royal Navy visited the German Navy at Kiel, and the mood was friendly.
Best wishes for a pleasant journey.
Comrades in the past and always.
We should also remember that just as there were forces pushing for war in Europe before 1914, there were also very strong forces for peace. Many Europeans assumed that after a century of progress, prosperity, and peace, that they had become so sophisticated that war was something they would no longer do, that war was simply improbable. There was a very large middle-class peace movement. There were those like Norman Angell, the British journalist, who argued that war was simply not going to pay, that it made no economic sense because Europeans' economies were now so tightly intertwined. And there were those like Jean Jaurès, the great French socialist, who worked very hard against war and who talked about ways in which the peace could be maintained. In the summer of 1914, many, in fact, assumed that some of the tensions of the past had gone and that Europe was in for a long period of prolonged peace. There was indeed a sort of complacency that Europe had got through a series of crises in the Balkans successfully, and that seemed to indicate that it would be able to do so in the future. Furthermore, a lot of European countries, as we have seen, were distracted by what was going on at home. Socialism was becoming increasingly powerful, and working class militancy was growing, and in the summer of 1914, there were a number of strikes, many of them quite militant, across Europe. Britain had particular preoccupations. It was deeply worried and deeply divided over the question of home rule for Ireland, and many in Britain, in fact, feared that there might be a civil war. There was another distraction for the British as well, and that was the very militant movement for votes for women. The suffragettes, at least the militant wing on the suffragettes, were prepared to use increasingly violent means to push their cause. And so when the assassination occurred in Sarajevo on the 28th of June, the reaction at first, as we have seen, was one that this is a tragedy, but not necessarily going to lead to something really dangerous. Arthur Nicholson, for example, the head of the Foreign Office, wrote at the time,
"The tragedy which has recently occurred at Sarajevo will, I hope, not lead to any further complications."
What we then did in our series is look at how that single act, which was in itself an accident, led to a massive catastrophe. And it's here, really, I think, that we need to look at the individual decisions made by individual countries and by individual people. And so we have looked at the decisions made by the government in Vienna as it decides to deal with Serbia once and for all. We've looked at the decision by Russia to come to Serbia's defense. We've looked at the decision by Germany to back Austria-Hungary. And then we've looked at those final fatal decisions as the armies begin to mobilize. And we've examined the flaws in the military plans, particularly in Germany and in Russia, which did not allow the governments to mobilize against just one power. The British were watching this from the sidelines with, I think, a certain amount of horror. The British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, did his best to suggest negotiations, conferences, mediation, but it was all to no avail. And so by the evening of the 4th of August, Britain was at war. We still look back at the First World War and commemorate it, as we have been doing now, because its consequences were so enormous. In terms of human life alone, 9 million men died. Twice as many probably were injured, wounded, and in some cases never really properly to recover. And then just as the war was coming to an end, a dreadful influenza epidemic struck the world, and possibly as many as 50 million people died. Europe never recovered its former dominance in the world. It had spent its wealth down, wasted its young men, drained the resources of its empires. The map of Europe looked very different after 1918. Austria-Hungary had disappeared, and in place of that great empire were now a number of small and often quarreling countries. Russia had a revolution in 1917, and in the place of Tsarist regime, you now got Bolshevism, which, as Soviet communism, was going to have a huge impact. The war also hastened the disappearance of the Western empires. Those living in the empires no longer had faith that European civilization was somehow more advanced. And the war speeded up the rise of the United States to world power. Perhaps worst of all, it didn't seem to settle things enough, and so 20 years later there was another, even more dreadful, world war. We still wonder who is to blame. We still try and understand that catastrophe. I think it's almost impossible to come up with a clear answer about how the war started. What I have tried to do here is to understand that world of 1914 and to give you a sense of the individuals who made those fateful decisions. In my view, what they suffered from was a failure of imagination and a lack of courage to stand up to those who said there was no choice but to go to war. I think we need to remember that there are almost always choices. Thank you for downloading this program from the BBC. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/ww1.